if you know Jordan Peterson. This has been a bizarre, bizarre phenomenon. During this week, I've actually found out that there are hundreds of Jordan Peterson meetups across the world. So you've got people coming together and they are advertising this is a Jordan Peterson meetup in the same way that there's a church. So you can go on the yellow pages, as it were, and you can visit a church or a Jordan Peterson meetup. So this guy and the cultural impact that he's made in a very short space of time is nothing short of staggering. And that is why we decided to deal a little bit with this phenomenon. Now, last week, I spoke a little bit about his ideas, and it was an introduction to Jordan Peterson, and I think by and large, hopefully this came across, that I'm quite a big fan of this guy. I think he's got a lot of interesting, thought-provoking ideas, and I spoke with a lot of appreciation. So just to recap some of that, I think what Peterson, there are still a couple of seats here. Lorraine, do you want to come here? Just sit by my feet and learn. Yeah. So I think just to sum up some of the things that I appreciate from Jordan Peterson is the fact that I think he's given us language to make sense of this political correctness. I think a lot of people looked around them, couldn't really make sense of what was going on in terms of just catchphrases like white privilege and gender heteronormativity and patriarchy and how this all came in this very weird bag. And he gave us some language to try and make sense of it within a cultural Marxism or a neo-Marxism, etc. I spoke a little bit about that last week. If you want to, you can just check out the podcast when it's available. So I've got appreciation for that. I think this guy really understands the history of ideas, and he also understands how central the Christian worldview has been to especially the West, but just the history of ideas, a lot of things that we take for granted in this world. And in that sense, I quite like the fact that he gives the new atheists he schools them a little bit, just in their naive, dismissive attitude towards Christianity as being this Bronze Age mythology that's just ridiculous. And Jordan Peterson has really done, speaking from a Christian perspective, he's done us a great service in that. He's also revealed the absolute depth of the biblical stories. These stories that's, again, been dismissed as primitive, he's gone into it, and it's amazing. I spoke about it last week, the fact that he can speak for 3 hours on Cain and Abel, and it has millions of views. That is absurd. I mean, you guys don't listen when I speak for 5 minutes. But it says something about this, of this personality. And lastly, what I appreciate is the fact that this guy's sort of a secular pastor to a large extent. A lot of young people, especially men, is flocking to him and just asking for guidance. And it's, again, so weird. This is the 21st century, and you just have thousands of people writing him and asking for advice and just buying a book called 12 Rules for Life. If you told me that 10 years ago that a book called 12 Years for Life is going to be the number one bestseller globally, I would have laughed. It is a very, very strange phenomenon. Having said all of that, today I would like to critique some of his ideas, but that's difficult. For one, he's smarter than I am. Secondly, he's a very slippery customer. It's very difficult to figure out exactly what Jordan Peterson believes and does not believe. So what I'm going to say today comes from a place of humility, where I'm trying to make sense and I can flag certain issues, but it's definitely not the roasting of Jordan Peterson. I am way too young and uneducated to stand in that position. But let me have a go at it. So first of all, politically speaking, Jordan Peterson is a child of the Enlightenment. What I mean by that is this guy is super individualistic in his thinking. So he propagates a view that we should see society as a collection of individuals. So he is very, very, very individualistic in his thought. And that is definitely not a given. That is a product of the Enlightenment. And you can see this this comes out in his thought on many occasions. So for instance, he would say, I don't speak for people, I only speak for myself. Now that is a very individualistic statement. And what he's trying to do there is he's saying, I'm not going to play this group identity game. I'm not going to speak on behalf of anybody else. I'm not going to speak on behalf of men or white or neoliberals, as that lady just threw all the taglines against him in that trailer for that documentary. He simply says, I'm just going to speak for myself. And that reveals something of his hyper-individualism. This guy, I think, is haunted by what happened in the 20th century. The totalitarian regimes of Stalin, of Mao Zedong, what we saw with communism, Marxism, and also what we saw with Hitler. And what those guys did is they divided the world into the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, in other words, the working class and capital, and just... it was almost impossible for you to escape that group identity. And Peterson sees that as a very, in his word, a very bad idea. It's a very bad idea. With Hitler, you saw something of the same. He divided the world into the Aryans and everybody else, with various levels of everything, everybody else, with the Jews being at the bottom. But again, this binary view and dividing the world into groups. And Peterson is allergic to anything like that. So when he hears the word like white privilege, heteronormativity, patriarchy, his red flags just go off, and he's very worried about that. Now, I have appreciation for this because identity politics, I think, has gone a little bit crazy as of late, and I think Peterson is speaking into that. But one thing that I wrestle with is I don't think that we can escape group identity. I think there's a legitimate group identity as well, so especially from a biblical perspective. So I agree with Peterson when I just think from my, I want to say, Enlightenment Western perspective. But when I read the Bible, I realize that there is something group about us. So in Daniel 9, we read this, for example. This is Daniel 9, verse 3 to 11. So Daniel is praying. Then I turned my face to the Lord God, seeking him by prayer and pleas for mercy with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. We have sinned and done wrong and acted wickedly and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and rules. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. To you, O Lord, belongs righteousness, but to us open shame. As at this day, to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and to all Israel, those who are near and those who are far away, in all the lands to which you have driven them because of the treachery that they have committed against you. To us, O Lord, belongs open shame, to our kings, to our princes, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belongs mercy and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against you and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God by walking in his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. All Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, refusing to obey your voice. And the curse and oath that are written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out upon us because we have sinned against him. Here's the weird thing. The big transgression happened a generation before Daniel is praying this. And Daniel is reaping the fruit, the repercussions of their decision. So these guys did not follow God. Now he is sitting in Babylon. So this is decades after the event in question. But notice how Daniel frames the prayer. He says, we have transgressed. We are the sinners. All of Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside. That's collective language. And I don't quite know how to make sense of it. But I think it would be insincere to say that a biblical perspective is also to just treat people as individuals. Because there's something substitutionary about a lot of the biblical language that we pick up. So Daniel here is accepting responsibility for the sins of his ancestors. Now, if you say that to Jordan Peterson and most of us in this room, we get very uneasy. that we need to pay for the sins of our Afrikaner nationalistic parents or of colonialism or whatever. But it seems to me that there is a representational language that we find in the Bible. Now, Peterson would say his big tagline is, you take responsibility, clean your room, clean your own rubbish. That's his line. Clean your own house, clean your, because you cannot clean everybody else's rooms. You need to clean your own room. That's individualistic language. But what we see here with Daniel is he's cleaning the room on behalf of a lot of people. Now, I'm not quite sure what to make of this, but I see this representational language. And modern people hate this. They hate this type of language. Billy Joel, one of my favorite songwriters, he says this, "Well, I wasn't raised Catholic, but I used to go to mass with my friends, and I view the whole business as a lot of very enthralling hocus-pocus. There's a guy hanging upon the wall in the church, nailed to a cross and dripping blood, and everybody's blaming themselves for that man's torment. But I said to myself, forget it. I had no hand in that evil. I have no original sin. There's no blood of any sacred martyr on my hands. I pass on all of this." So here's a guy, a modern guy, and he cannot relate to anything of this representational sin, of Adam representing sin and man's fallenness into sin, and Jesus representing our redemption from sin. He cannot do that because what he says is, I didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't eat the apple. I didn't die on the cross. I'm not going to feel sorry, and I'm not going to be thankful. It's got nothing to do with me. He cannot tap into this representational language at all. And that's why it's a very unpopular idea. And you know what's interesting? In the last couple of years, whenever somebody talks about substitutionary atonement, are you guys familiar with that concept? The idea that Jesus took on the sins of the world in our place, and God the Father, so to speak, punishes him, but he punishes us. But God takes the fall. Jesus takes the fall in our stead. That has become very unpopular within Christian circles today. And we refuse that understanding of the cross in many circles. And I think it reveals just the fact that we are modern people. We are Western people. So we say that's unfair. We say, why would God punish his son for the mistakes of other people? But at least for the majority of Christian, for the church history, that has been the dominant view. Now, I think there are other ways of understanding the cross as well. I'm not trying to say that substitutionary atonement theory is the only way of understanding the cross. But I think the reason why we dislike it is because of this enlightenment individualism. And we do not accept the idea that a group needs to be punished for an individual, or an individual needs to be punished for a group. Does that make sense? This doesn't look very good. So most people find this tremendously unfair. But most people today find it tremendously unfair. But most people throughout history find it tremendously gracious. Have you ever heard that in a church? Grace. Every second song that you sing in a church, grace, grace, grace. And it's predicated on this idea that Jesus did it on our behalf, and that's given to us now. We inherit that through, not through our own doing, but through the grace of Jesus. That is a very primary Christian principle. One thing that I notice, very absent from Peterson's thought, is grace. I haven't heard him or read him on grace. The way he would interpret the cross is, take up your cross, scale that mountain, you know, sacrifice. And I think it's valid. I think it's valid interpretations. But he doesn't make any connection of that event standing in and of itself, I want to say almost ontologically by itself, and that event changes my standing with God and with other people. He does not make that connection, or at least I haven't read it or heard him say that. He would rather say, we need to emulate that. Now, that is a fair way of looking at Jesus. It's called Christ Exemplar. Christ was this example, and we are supposed to emulate this example. But if that's the only thing you say about the cross, then I think you fall short. Christ stood in our place, took the sins on him, and that changes our standing. We didn't take any responsibility. We didn't clean our room. We suck. Yet he did that. And somehow, through deep magic, to quote Lewis, our room becomes clean, so to speak. So this is not Petersonian language, but I think it is biblical language, and that's something that I would push him on. I mean, just consider this passage. This is Isaiah 53. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. That is substitutionary. And I am not sure that Peterson would accept this in the way that I accept it, and in the way that I think most of church history accepts it. So that's my one point of critique, and I can see some of you guys are not accepting this, and you are saying that this is blasphemy, and you're saying I didn't criticize your God, so why do you criticize my God? Let's bank that there for a moment, and then we can talk a little bit more about it in the Q&A. For now, I just want to play us a clip of Jordan Peterson. I'm sure most of you have seen it, and after that, I want to point to something else that bothers me somewhat about his thought.
Ask me, do you believe in God? Which I don't like that question. First of all, it's an attempt to box me in a sense. And the reason that it's an attempt to box me in is because the question is asked so that I can be firmly placed on one side of a binary argument. And the reason I don't like to answer it is because A, I don't like to be boxed in, and B, because I don't know what the person means by believe or God. And they think they know. And the probability that they construe belief and construe God the same way I do is virtually zero. So it's a question that doesn't work for me on multiple levels of analysis. But strangely enough, just as we were talking, the answer to that question popped into my head. I act as if God exists. Now you can decide for yourself whether that means that I believe in him, so to speak. But I act as if he exists. So that's a good enough answer for that. Then with regards to these other issues, the divinity of Christ, well, I would say the same problems with the question formulation obtain. What do you mean by divine? And also, what do you mean by Christ? These are very, very difficult questions. Now, I believe that, for all intents and purposes, I believe that the Logos is divine. Insofar as if by divine you mean of ultimate value, of ultimate transcendent value, yes, it's divine. It's associated with death and rebirth, clearly, because the Logos dismantles you and rebuilds you. So that's what happens when you make an error. When you make an error, some part of you has to go. That's a sacrifice. You have to let it go. Sometimes it's a big part of you. Sometimes it can be such a big part of you that you actually die, right, instead of dying and being reborn. Is there something more than merely metaphorical about the idea of dying and being reborn? Yes, there is, because those are associated with physiological transformations. What's the ultimate extent of that? That's a good question. You know, the question is, what happens to the world around you as you increasingly embody the Logos? And the answer to that is, we don't know. We don't know what the ultimate level of this. Now, the hypothesis is, and it's a hypothesis that extends to some degree to Buddha as well. The hypothesis is that there has been one or two individuals who managed that, and that in their management of that, they transcended death itself. Well, then you might ask yourself, well, what do you mean by transcended death? Well, in the case of Christ, let's assume he was a historical figure for the time being, which I think is the simplest thing to assume. I think there's sufficient evidence to conclude that. You could conclude otherwise, but I personally feel that there's sufficient evidence to conclude that. Is his resurrection real? Well, his spirit lives on. That's certainly the case.
In what sense do you mean spirit, just to qualify that?
Well, let's imagine that a spirit is a pattern of being. And we know that patterns can exist, patterns can be transmitted across multiple substrates, right? Vinyl, electronic impulses, air, vibrations in your ear, neurological patterns, dance. It's all the translation of what you might describe as a spirit, right? It's that pattern. It's independent of its material substrate. Well, Christ's spirit lives on. It's had a massive effect across time. Well, is that an answer to the question? Did his body resurrect? I don't know. The accounts aren't clear, for one thing. What the accounts mean isn't clear. I don't know what happens to a person if they bring themselves completely into alignment. I've had intimations of what that might mean. We don't understand the world very well. We don't understand how the world could be mastered if it was mastered completely. We don't know how an individual might be able to manage that. We don't know what transformations that might make possible.
I'm going to get back to many of the things that he's saying, yeah, and I hope you guys paid attention, but yeah, I'm going to get back to some of the things that he said. But this introduces my second point of critique, and that is that I think Jordan Peterson, his approach resembles something of soft Gnosticism. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Gnosticism. So Gnosticism is difficult to, like Peterson, to explain, but it's a set of beliefs, and it was very prevalent within the first and second century churches. So I'm going to read to you just from this encyclopedia. Gnosticism refers to a body of related teachings, both ancient and modern, stressing the acquisition of gnosis, knowledge. It's secret esoteric knowledge. The knowledge sought is not strictly intellectual, but mystical. Not merely a detached knowledge of or about something, but knowing by experience or participation. I'm going to read something, and if you guys are familiar with Peterson, then you might pick up some of it. The gnosis is the knowledge of ultimate reality, particularly one's divine essence and origin. Gnosis reveals the spark of divinity within, which Gnostics think is obscured by ignorance and convention. Jesus is an illuminator who serves as a guide for another's awakening. This is the view of Jesus within Gnosticism. Now, the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung, a constant source of inspiration for the New Age, did much to introduce Gnosticism to the modern world by viewing it as a kind of ancient depth-like psychology and as superior psychologically to Orthodox Christianity. Then, I'm just giving you a spiel of some of what goes on in Gnosticism. Gnosticism teaches that something is desperately wrong with the universe and delineates the means to explain and rectify the situation. The cosmos is not good, nor was it created by an all-good God. The result was a material cosmos soaked with ignorance, pain, decay, and death. Human beings, or at least some of them, are in a position potentially to transcend their imposed limitations. Locked within the material shell of the human race is the spark of the highest spiritual reality. If this inner spark is fanned into flame, it can liberate humans from the world of matter and the demands of its confused and overbearing creator. They can ultimately evolve and ascend back into perfection through a process of self-discovery. Into this basic structure enters the idea of Jesus as a mystical redeemer of those trapped in materiality. He transcends from the spiritual realm with a message of self-redemption. With a message of self-redemption. Okay, I read that like a pastor. Tot zover. So why did I give you? I tried to give you a bit of a spiel of some of the core ideas within Gnosticism. Now, Peterson's intellectual hero is a guy called Carl Jung. So I spoke about Carl Jung last week, Sunday. And he was this Swiss psychiatrist. And if you want to understand Peterson's view, the psychological reading of the Bible, a lot of it stems from Carl Jung. But Carl Jung was actually, I think some say, but I'm pretty sure it's almost a consensus, that he was a well-known Gnostic. He was a Gnostic thinker, Carl Jung. And I think we can see some of this Gnostic thinking within Peterson's thinking. So you guys might have noticed that Peterson definitely seems to think that there's something very wrong with the world. And because he's such an animated character, when he goes into what is wrong with the world, he goes to the Russians, because the Russians saw a lot of what was wrong with the world. So he just goes into Solzhenitsyn and he makes a big case for everything that is bad with the world. Okay, and from a Christian perspective, I can appreciate that, because there's definitely such a thing called sin, and it is problematic. But Peterson is definitely immersing himself into that. Just I think a little bit more than most. Before I do that, I just quickly want to read you a quote that just gives you an idea of where Jung and these other guys find themselves. So Eliade, I'm probably mispronouncing his surname. If you go on Jordan Peterson's recommended books, his books are very much recommended. Joseph Campbell is the guy who popularized Carl Jung. So I'm just going to read this. In analyzing the similarities between the mythologists, those three guys, Robert Elwood concluded that the three modern mythologists, all of whom believe that myth reveals timeless truth, fulfill the role of Gnostics, the Gnostics had in antiquity. The diverse religious movements covered by the term Gnosticism share the basic doctrine that the surrounding world is fundamentally evil or inhospitable, that we are trapped in the world through no fault of our own, and that we can be saved from the world only through secret knowledge, through gnosis. Elwood claimed that the three mythologists were modern Gnostics through and through, remarking, whether in Augustan Rome or modern Europe, democracy all too easily gave way to totalitarianism. Technology was as readily used for battle as for comfort, and immense wealth lay alongside abysmal poverty. Gnostics past and present sought answers not in the course of outward human events, but in knowledge of the world's beginning, of what lies above and beyond the world, and of the secret places of the human soul. So here you can see this massive emphasis that the Gnostics put on the world is fallen. There's something, fundamentally evil and inhospitable about the world. We see this again, there's something wrong. The result was a material cosmos soaked with ignorance, pain, decay, and death. And I think that Peterson buys very much into this. Now again, as a Christian, I believe that there's such a thing as sin and there's something wrong with the world. But what I find interesting about Peterson is this is where he starts. This is the place where he begins. So he often speaks about his Descartesian moment. So Descartes questioned everything and everything and everything. And the one thing that he was left with is, I cannot question the fact that I am questioning. And then he said, I think, therefore I am. And that was his starting block. And from there, he built his whole philosophy. Peterson did the same sort of move, except he stopped with, one thing is undeniable, there's suffering, there's evil. So that's his starting point. And you can see this often, because his starting point is chaos. Have you picked that up? He always starts with chaos. And then he says that we need to order the chaos. That is what is important. But what I find interesting from an Orthodox Christian perspective, we start with, in the beginning, God created the universe, the world, and everything in it, and it was good. So I think he jumps to chaos too quickly. I think from a biblical Christian perspective, we say that God created the universe and it was good. But Peterson starts with chaos. And even when he does his biblical teachings, he would say that God created the world. He made order out of chaos. And I'm not quite sure that that's clear from the Genesis account. I think he created something out of nothing. I don't quite think that he created order out of chaos. That's the one thing. The other one thing is, because of this chaos and the fact that we need to fight this chaos with good, you find a lot of dualism within the thinking of Peterson. He's a very dualistic thinker. It's always good and evil fighting each other. So that's why he says, every good thing you do, and I like this when he says this, brings heaven just a little bit closer to the world. And everything bad that you do brings hell just a little bit closer to this world. So he's got a very dualistic view that is not necessarily unchristian, but it is definitely Gnostic. It is definitely Gnostic. That's why you often hear in his lectures the principle of the yin-yang. You guys have heard that. This face-off between good and evil. And it's interesting because it's unfair to say this is Peterson's ideas, but it's definitely Jung's ideas. Jung thought that the logos is reason, science, that is masculine. Have you guys picked that up? That is the masculine trait. I told you that this might be a little bit boring, but just bear with me. That is masculine. That's the logos, that's reason, that's order. Then you've got eros, that's mystical, that's imagination, and that's feminine. Now this, I've heard echoes of that in Peterson's ideas, but this is definitely how Jung conceptualized this idea. Now what I find interesting is that in probably the most famous Gnostic book, The Gospel According to Thomas, you see this constant dualism. You see Jesus as this teacher trying to lift people up to try and get them to attain this gnosis. And then at the end, you have this very politically incorrect passage. This is saying 114 from the Gospel of Thomas. Simon Peter said to them, "Mary should leave us, for females are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "See, I am going to attract her to make her male, so that she too might become a living spirit that resembles you males. For every female element that makes itself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Now we think, how dare you? This is horrible. And it is actually quite funny because Elaine Pagels and a lot of the feminine theologians, they love the Gnostic Gospels. I still haven't figured it out. But I think a Gnostic reading, the way that Carl Jung would read this, and even Peterson, the way he might read this, is that you've got these two elements, chaos and order. And unless you order your chaos, unless you're a woman, chaos, becoming man, order, you cannot live within this kingdom of heaven. You cannot live this life at the fullest because your life is still chaotic. You have to move over to order. Does that make sense? So that's how I think the Gnostics would read the Gospel According to Thomas, at least this saying, from a Jungian perspective. I don't think... Now, remember, this is representational language, so don't get stuck with the fact that women can't go to heaven. But, like I said, the Orthodox Christianity starts with the idea that God is good and that he is in control and that he created and that he is sovereign as well. And he's a personal God. He's not this abstract thing, this force of good and evil that's fighting each other. There is dualism that we find within the Christian worldview, but it's not on this level. Let me just stop that there. Let me make two more points and then I will release you from chaos. So within Gnosticism, we often hear this, there's a spark of divinity within everyone. We often hear this within Peterson, there's a spark of divinity. Now, that's not necessarily a problem because within Orthodox Christianity, we would talk about that you are made in the image of God. And I think Peterson would just maybe use that analogy for the same idea. But the spark of divinity in Gnosticism is more an idea of self-discovery. So Jesus' message is one of self-redemption. It is a sort of metaphysical aid. So the spark of divinity, and this is a fundamental difference between Gnosticism and Orthodox Christianity, is that there's this idea within Gnosticism that we can transcend, because if we use the spark of divinity, if we fan this little spark and it goes into a flame, then we can ascend into this into divinity. We can reach this. And when Peterson speaks about Jesus and his divinity, I cannot help but think that he frames it within a Gnostic way. He says that if it is possible, if you've aligned yourself, that's the word he used in the talk, if you align yourself to such a degree, and then he refers to Buddha a little bit, he's referred to Jesus, and he's also referred to Socrates in the same way. If you align yourself like that, then you become one with the Logos or something like that, and maybe there the divine and the material can interact. But I don't think that it is that is the biblical view. I think that is a Gnostic view of how these things interact. It's self-help. Let's read this quote. This is from Stephen Hüller. He wrote a book, The Gnostic Jung, referring to Carl Jung. If we come to envision the Gnostics as early death psychologists, then it immediately becomes apparent why the Gnostic teaching and practice was radically different from the teaching and practice of Christian orthodoxy. The knowledge of the heart for which the Gnostics strove could not be acquired by merely fervently believing that the sacrificial act of one divine man in history could lift the burden of guilt and frustration from one man's shoulders and assure perpetual beatitude beyond the confines of mortal existence. So what he's saying there is, the Gnostics do not believe that there's this representational Jesus who did it on our behalf. That's not how we view that sacrificial act. Rather, the Gnostics did not negate the greatness of the mission of the mysterious person whom his disguised men knew as the Rabbi Yeshua of Nazareth. That's Jesus, by the way. The Savior became to the Gnostic but a means to an end greater than themselves. These became inducements and devices which might in some fashion be conducive to personal knowing, which once attained requires neither law nor faith. To them, as to Carl Jung, many centuries later, theology and ethics were but stepping stones on the road to self-knowledge. So this is what the cross and redemption means within Gnosticism. It is this self-help, self-knowledge element, but it's definitely not Christianity. That's the one thing. The last point that I want to make is when the Gnostics speak about God, it's often beyond comprehension. So you can even see this here. So in the Gospel of the Egyptians, which is also a famous Gnostic gospel text, the ultimate reality is said to be the unrevealable, unmarked, ageless, unproclaimable Father. The text speaks of giving praise to the great invisible spirit who is the silence of the silent silence. So it's very far away. It is not something that we can quite comprehend. And when Peterson is asked on this, he would always say, I don't think we understand the world very well. I don't think we can quite make sense of what God is. Now, again, I'm a little bit suspicious that sounds a lot like Gnosticism, where he is just completely other, that any description labeling him will be problematic. Again, within Orthodox Christianity, we believe in a personal God who was revealed in the person of Jesus. And that is very much different from Gnosticism. I said this was my last point. I lied. This is my second last point. I think Peterson agrees a lot with someone like Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant was a great philosopher. And when he says in this video, I act as if God exists, he's very much Kantian in his view. Kant made a divide. He says, look, all of these evidence for the existence of God, all of these proofs, that's silly. We can just park that. We cannot know God metaphysically, but it's still meaningful to use God as the ethical grounding for life. So we can use that. So that is very much a Kantian view on Peterson's part. And Kant said that the narrative of Jesus is the archetype of the life perfectly pleasing to God. So Peterson and Kant are very much in agreement here that is a beautiful life. But we can't really know anything metaphysically about it, but it is simply a regulative system for the moral life. In Christianity, the question is, I think he's a person. I don't just think it is a moral system. Okay. So there are many things within Gnosticism, and there are many things within Peterson that I agree with, just because it sounds like I'm calling him a heretic. But he cannot be a heretic because he doesn't call himself a Christian, which is fine. He doesn't. If he said, "I'm a Christian theologian," I would have said, "Yeah, I think you're a Gnostic Christian theologian." But he's not. He says he's a psychologist who reads the Bible from a psychological perspective, and he gives us tremendous insight into this. So I don't think we have to treat him as anything else. But I also think that we shouldn't confuse this with Orthodox Christianity. As a matter of fact, I think we can listen for the undertones of Gnosticism here and there. But in the same way that a guy like Thomas Aquinas looked at Aristotle, he was a Greek. That guy was definitely he didn't teach Sunday school. Jesus didn't even come by then. But he looked at Aristotle's ideas and said, "This is remarkable." And he used a lot of it in his great works, in his Summa Theologica. So as long as we see Peterson as that, as a great conversation partner, but not as a theologian, not as a pastor, I think we're on the right track. What I also like about the guy is the fact that he's really humble. He says, "I don't know yet." And I really hope that he knows one of these days. And not in a Gnostic no, but in knowing a person. I really hope and pray that for Jordan. I think he's helping us to see the life-giving beauty of these archetypes. But the thing about Christianity historically is it's been stubbornly historical. Christianity has been stubbornly historical. This fight between the Gnostics and the church happened in the first century. The church fathers like Irenaeus and others fought against the Gnostics and called them heretics, excommunicated them. And a lot of them paid with their lives because it was a big fight. But they said, "We cannot help but see this as a historical event. So I appreciate your psychological reading. I appreciate the mystical and the mythical aspect, but you cannot divorce this from history." And the reason why I think these guys were so adamant, these early church fathers, is because it was the only way for them to make sense of the Gospels. Because these were competing Gospels. You had the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, of Mary Magdalene, and they were competing with the Gospel of Mary and Mark and all of this. And not Mary and Mark, Mary Magdalene and Thomas, etc. And the people proclaiming the Gospel according to Mark and Matthew and Luke and John, they were the ones in trouble. You know why? Because Caesar doesn't care if somebody says, if there's a Gospel that says, "Be a better you. Transcend from your circumstances. Become enlightened." He doesn't care about that gospel. What Caesar cares about is this gospel of Mark, which says Jesus is king and Caesar isn't. So those guys paid the price. They were in trouble, not the Gnostic guys. Although when you read the Vinci Code and all of these things, they always present this alternative gospel, the real guys, as they were persecuted. That was not the case, at least not in the first couple of centuries. The other reason why they were so stubborn is because they looked at John 1, the prologue of John's Gospel, and it is beautiful. And there's so much of, and I'm sure Jordan Peterson will do a 5-hour lecture on this one day, and he rightly should, because there's so much here. But just listen to it. "In the beginning was the Word." The word that we use there is the translated word logos. If you know anything about Peterson, he's got a love affair with the word logos. "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." Peterson, would, if he doesn't already, would absolutely love that. Light shining against darkness, the Logos helping us to do that. This was a... the Gnostics would have loved this. The Greeks would have loved this. It's a great psychological understanding. But John doesn't stop there. "And the Word became flesh." And that's where most people say, this is weird. That's incarnation right there. The Word, this Logos, this abstract principle that Peterson does hundreds of lectures on, became flesh, at least in the Christian understanding. He became flesh, and he dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. "For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known," he being Jesus. I think Peterson, like the Gnostics, and like many other people, stop short with that first passage, John 1:2-5. They think of him as this abstract principle. But if it is true that the Logos became flesh, if it is true that he dwelt among us, if it is true that this was the fullness of God, notice how Peterson and the Gnostics frame it. You ascend to God. Buddha, Socrates, they were in such alignment that they could spark divinity. John said, divinity came down. We didn't become divine. Divinity came down. There's a difference. But look at the implication of that as well. The Word became flesh, dwelt among us. We saw the glory of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. For from him, his fullness, we have received grace upon grace. If you understand that divine came to earth and became human, there's one thing that you cannot miss, and that's grace. And that is one thing that I find missing in Peterson's thinking, is the idea of grace. And I appreciate the fact that he is not getting on this compassionate train that is the world at this stage, where people are not taking responsibility, and if somebody's murdered 50 people, we say you are really just a product of the system, and we apologize for the system. Sorry, Ted Bundy. Sorry, Jeffrey Dahmer. We really apologize. So he is saying take responsibility within this climate where everybody's apologizing for everything, and I appreciate that. But in the fullness of the Christian story, there's one thing that you cannot miss, and that is the Logos. We didn't ascend to it. The Logos came to us, and that act is gracious. End of the game. That is gracious, and we can respond to that. And now we can ascend. Now we can go to this life, but we don't do it through law. We don't do it through Moses. We don't do it, forgive me, through 12 rules. We do it because Christ did it. And that means that even if you screw up your 12 rules or the 600 and something that Moses gave, and at least the Jews developed, then you're still okay because Christ did it. This is a different dynamic, but it is profound. This is not supposed to be a sermon, but it feels like I can pray, so I'm going to do that. And then we can go into Q&A. Lord Jesus, we thank you that we can engage with so many ideas. We thank you for a guy like Jordan Peterson, who's stimulated the discussion, who's helped many people who couldn't care less about you to really understand the value and the depth of the scriptures. We also want to pray for him, Lord. I pray that he can move beyond the first 5 verses of John. Not just see it as logos, not just see it in an abstract reality, but see it as incarnate, and just the tremendous grace that comes with it. Thank you for that story, Lord. Thank you that we do not have to apply rules to attain this divinity, that we do not have to do this to attain nirvana or whatever we call these things today, but that it's already been done, and that we are wooed by what you did on the cross. We are not just inspired, but we are transformed because of what happened there. And I pray that in this time when we are talking about taking responsibility and seeing all of the mythical elements, that's beautiful, the archetypal elements in the Bible, that we wouldn't lose this one fact, and that is the fact that the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us. And now we are in the grips of grace and truth. In Jesus' name we pray that. Amen. Okie dokie. So now I've criticized your euro. But if you want to make comments or questions, then you are more than welcome. There's a microphone over there. I can see some of the Jordan Peterson disciples are up in arms.
Hey, Johan.
Hey.
Hi, Johan. So, as a lobster, self-proclaimed lobster, I'm here to defend Jordan Peterson. And just the 3 things. I think he's not a Christian, and I completely agree with you. But just perhaps 3 thoughts. The first about individualism. You'll remember Rule 6. 6, set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. which is what Jesus said, take splinter out of your own eye for... And I think that the problem with the individual is first sort out yourself before you criticize others. And so many in the... When you're part of a collection, just blame the collection. And always the collection. So we need the balance of the individual. I feel especially in South Africa, because, you know, we're such fantastic Afrikaans people, and we're part of the NG Kerk or Jaloeg, or we've got our church. And we need to take personal responsibility instead of blaming the church, even. Secondly, Jordan Peterson has fantastic videos about grace when it comes to forgiveness, and after that, he says, repent. And I'm going to reference here to his advice for marriage, and I remember a video about when you cheat on your partner, what do you do? Forgive yourself, and then repent of yourself, because, you know, forgiveness is not good enough. He calls for repentance, and just really get behind it. And lastly, perhaps Jung. I mean, it would be fantastic this time, sometime this year, if you could do a talk about Jung. That would, I think, would be fantastic for Dialoog. In Jung's memoir is called Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. He actually tries to prove the existence of God through archetypes. So they actually tries to confirm that he's actually trying to prove God's existence. Although I can understand the Gnostic thing, and of course, Jung isn't correct there. I mean, he's human. And Jordan Peterson is fallible as well. Finally, you were really good, and I really enjoyed tonight's talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. I'll just respond to that last comment. Let's take a few, because I think it might overlap.
Thank you. I think the critique was generally quite fair. So I just actually want to point out a minor thing. I don't think that your representation of his view of order and chaos is quite fair. I don't think that he argues that for a movement from chaos into order. Instead, I think he argues that you need both. So you've pointed out how order is seen, you know, in archetypal language as a masculine force or in the masculine domain, and how chaos is in the feminine domain. But there are also other things associated with it. So with order would be kind of conservatism, and with chaos would be progressivism. And, you know, he particularly also talks about the hero archetype, where the hero needs to confront a dragon which he encounters in the unknown. And the unknown is kind of the domain of chaos, so to speak. And for progress, society needs to basically go beyond what is already there. And it needs to effectively encounter or confront the unknown. And it also needs the order as a basis and as a kind of the inheritance of wisdom from previous generations. But I definitely don't think that he argues that the one is more important than the other. I do think that he argues against the contemporary focus on progressivism. So he does believe that the pendulum has swung too far to that side. But I don't think he argues that as a sort of permanent view.
Hello, Jan. Thanks. I thought that was a great talk.
Can I speak to Herman, please?
Don't worry. So the Gnosticism thing is, I think, a very fair, and we need to talk about that more. I think because it's Irenaeus thought it was like the mother of all heresy because it's so close to Christianity, because it sounds a lot like Christianity.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, what I want to say is about the individualism thing. So I don't know what Jordan Peterson says. I haven't seen that much of him, but one could argue that the individualism he inherited from the Enlightenment inherited from Protestant Christianity, this big idea that you're responsible for your own sin, and I know you brought the cross in there, and I don't know if that's quite relevant, because the critique, as far as I can see, the modern critique against the cross is not against substitutionary atonement, Jesus dying in our stead, but against the penal side of it, the God punishing Jesus rather than Jesus taking the sin on himself. But either way, that the you know, I don't think it has much to do with individualism, although I think our culture does have an individualism problem. I don't know quite how we would counter that through, I think, the thinking around community and stuff like that that Wendell Berry does is quite cool. But, yeah, I think if you're going to criticize his individualism, you have to not do it through the cross. There might be some other way in the Bible to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Ah, Johan, dankie. Was baie cool geweest. Ek het 'n baie kort vraag. Is net, ons het 'n klomp vriende wat ons gehoek kan kry op Jordan Peterson vir obvious redes, want hy is nogal 'n fenomeen. En jy het verlede week gepraat oor hy is nogal die gateway drug into Christianity. Net, wie sal jou persoonlike skrywers of YouTube channels of wat ook al wees, wat jy sal perscribe as 'n Christen, wat hulle moet gaan jump van na Jordan Peterson? As hulle nou 'n bietjie hulle goedjies al deurgedink het, wie is die volgende Christen nou wie het met aanbeweeg wat 'n groot platform het. Ja.
Cool.
Okay, thanks. I think we're going to give you one just chance to answer these questions, and then if we have time, we'll take another.
The nice thing about taking all of the questions together is that I can dodge the ones that I don't want to deal with. So, with the individualism thing, I am very conflicted with that, because I see Daniel 9, okay, and I see there's something going on there. Then I can also see that we don't like, so forget about penal substitutionary atonement. Just let's look at the Billy Joel. That's got nothing to do with penal. It's got the idea that this thing has somehow relates to me. I can't identify with that. We don't like that idea. So I'm not necessarily just picking on the guys questioning penal substitutionary atonement. I think there's something that makes us uncomfortable about representation. And that is why I am, I don't like, and the only reason why I said this is because I get that the term white privilege and patriarchy and everything that comes with it has been hijacked, okay? And you've got ideologues who's wielding that like a hammer, and we need to find different language. But I cannot help but feel that somehow there are things that's systemic. There are things that's systemic, and that we cannot help but see within a systemic way. And I, for instance, this is not necessarily the systemic bit, but when the Springboks win a game, okay, now this is metaphorical, so you don't have to try and remember. But we feel chuffed about it. We feel good about it. So somehow what they did represent us to one degree or the other. There's something representational about that. When I think of the past, and I think of the Buddha giving the English hell at Colenso and Spionkop, and I read the accounts of these English trying to say these bunch of bloody Buddha are just they're really killing us, and Colenso and Spionkop and Magersfontein, and I get a kick out of that. For some reason I get a kick out of it, and if I can get a kick out of that and I can sort of identify with that, perhaps I can get a wrong type of kick because of what happened in apartheid. When I watch an apartheid movie, I don't feel like I want to go listen to good Darren music afterwards to celebrate my culture. There is shame that somehow follows me from there. In the same way that there's something, there's some pride that follows me from some of the Afrikaner achievements in history. Now, I'm not the best Afrikaner, but even I can feel some of that. And that makes me think with Daniel, Daniel being Daniel 9, I can also identify with this represent more than just me. And maybe there is something to say for standing in the place of that. That makes me unpopular among my white friends. But But that's where I stand. But here's my dilemma. When you look at Ezekiel 18, for example, you have this. Suppose he has a son who sees all the sins his father has committed, and though he sees them, he does not do likewise. He does not eat at the mountain shrines or raise his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. He does not defile his neighbor's wife. He doesn't oppress anyone. He doesn't hold collateral or commit robbery. He gives his bread to the hungry and he covers the naked with clothing. He keeps his hand, blah, blah, blah. Such a person will not die for his father's iniquity. He will certainly live. And then he goes on and he says, as for his father, he will die for the iniquity because he practiced fraud. He robbed his brother. Since the son has done what is just and right, carefully observing all my statutes, he will certainly live. So I have to make sense of that, because this would have been radical. This is, I think, if you talk about Protestant Christianity bringing in individualism, I am sure that they drew a lot of inspiration from a passage like this. I'm just trying to say I don't think it's that simple. And that's why I try to say, I'm not sure. I don't like the identity politics more than most people in this room. It annoys me to bits. But I don't think it's so easy to just say this is neo-Marxism and we can ignore it. It's stupid. From a biblical perspective, I see something that makes me a bit uncomfortable. So that was my argument in terms of individualism. In terms of Gnosticism, you said that Irenaeus was very hardcore against it, and for good reason, because it is so similar to Christianity. That is why Jordan Peterson and Jung and these guys, I'm not dissing them, saying that they're evil. They get much more of Christianity than Sam Harris, than Richard Dawkins, than the hardcore atheist. That's why I like a lot of what they say, and I can accept so much. I can redeem a lot, but I can also reject and say, this is where I disagree. This is where this rings Gnostic, and I disagree with that. So please don't see this as just picking on Peterson or Jung or whatever. This is me celebrating a lot of what they also get right in the process. Andre, you asked a question about if people like Jordan Peterson, how can they level up? The guy that I quite like, and who also has a big YouTube presence, is a guy called Robert Barron. Barron, B-A-R-R-O-N. He's a Catholic thinker. And he comments on most of these things. And I think he's a brilliant cultural critic, biblically very sound. I'm a big fan. As a matter of fact, I would pay a lot of money, well, not a lot of money, but I'll at least give James's car away, to see a discussion between Barron and Peterson. So Robert Barron, if you guys want to do that. Yeah, Isaac, I'm not entirely sure. You raised the whole thing about dualism again, and that chaos and order, it's not necessarily bad, and that's true. So when he talks about this being feminine, he is not saying that this is evil or bad. He's saying that these things need each other. So it's definitely, if you heard me saying that chaos is just bad, then that would be problematic. That's not Peterson's thinking. But it's definitely that as well. It definitely includes everything. So when he talks about chaos, he throws so many things in there. Original sin, imagination, the unknown, evil. So there's a lot in there. So that's why it's difficult to pinpoint him and to talk about these things in a meaningful way, because there's so much in there. And then when he talks about order, there's so much in there. That's why it's a little bit abstract. But what I do see in Peterson is this very dynamic dualism, and dualism is very much part of the fabric when it comes to Gnosticism, and that's something that I would like to flag. So for instance, when he, I think I spoke to his about his creation accounts. And chaos and creating order out of chaos and taming this fight between good and evil. But Christianity is Unitarian Trinitarian. Now, I know that's a mouthful, but it's not dualism. It means that within the Godhead, there's unity and there's diversity, and they are not in competition with each other, and they are sovereign. That is not this fight between good and evil. That's actually what I'm trying to say. I know that he's very complex in what he throws under that banner. But I'm just a little bit uncomfortable if you reduce all of reality to this dualism, because I would like to reduce it to a loving Godhead, unity in diversity, that is sovereign and in control, even if it doesn't always look that way. So that would be my how I would position myself. But these are big ideas, and we don't have time to talk about it. Peter, you are absolutely right that the Bible, and that's what Herman also alluded to, puts a lot on the individual. And that is why Christianity, and this is what Peterson is saying, historically, salvation was a group thing. So, and we can see this in the Old Testament. We can see elements of this in the Old Testament, where a whole town is saved. You know, Nineveh is saved. Everybody repented. But I mean, I don't think everybody repented in Nineveh with Jonah. But it's just the way that the ancients spoke about there's now redemption for these group of people. When we think of Old Testament violence, we often think, yes, how dare they? I mean, when he says you must kill the animals, the children, everything, go kill everything, then we say that's so unfair. I mean, kill the soldier, but don't kill the rest of them. But I think it's because we are thinking within this individualistic lens. They saw that as salvation for everyone, judgment for everyone, including livestock and whatever. And within that framework, you see God picking individuals. And that would have been weird for ancient readers. The fact that he picks Naaman the Syrian, this random guy who's not part of this house of salvation. The fact that Christianity, Peter only realized it afterwards. He says, now I know that God really chooses anyone who wants to know him. It's not about Jew or whatever. It's anyone. So he gets that individual element. So there's a massive individual element. And it's probably been the reason why we think as individuals today. And taking the log out of your own eye, I love that. And I spoke about it last week. But I don't think it's all. I think there is a corporate element as well. And I think Peterson and us, Western enlightened kids, like to forget that element. And you say that he's spoken a lot about grace. I'm glad. And I think his advice is good. This guy is solid. But I haven't seen him talk about grace on a corporate level. I haven't seen him connect grace with what God did on Golgotha. So that is the thing that I'm questioning.